Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Josh Kornbluh, the wonderful performance artist, about his upcoming one-man show, Andy Warhol, Good for the Jews. And after that, Armand Saia will be here talking about organic gardening and food networks here in northern New Mexico. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Fran Levine. She's director of the New Mexico History Museum, and Barbara Felix, architect and designer here in Santa Fe. And we're here to talk about Mary Elizabeth Jane Coulter, also known as Mary Coulter, who is being honored at an event that is co-sponsored by the History Museum and La Fonda on Friday and Saturday, the 1st and 2nd of April. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. We're so glad to be here.
Lovely to be here.
So who is this Mary Elizabeth Jane Coulter?
She was an architect and designer who was born in 1869 and passed away in 1958, and she worked for the Harvey Hotels for over 40 years.
And we live in the sort of orb of her design, and when we talk about Southwestern style or Santa Fe style, a lot of that really traces back to the design aesthetic that Mary Elizabeth Jane Coulter brought to the West, not just Santa Fe and not just New Mexico, but to the West through her affiliation with the Harvey Companies.
It's funny that, I mean, if I may say so, nobody's ever heard of her compared to John Gaumême or somebody like that.
It's true, and it's, I think, something the museum, La Fonda, myself, we all are trying probably single-handedly to rectify.
I would say that she has a very strong following of groupies.
Yes.
I would say that because when we look at the people who are coming in for the weekend to attend this event, we've brought people from Chicago who are primarily Fred Harvey family descendants, but we've also brought people from California, Arizona, New Mexico. People are finding out about this event, and what we're finding out is she has this huge following of people who are totally dedicated to her body of work. And it's a body of work that people who also love the American West have seen in really significant tourist destinations. And I would ask Barbara to talk a little bit about Grand Canyon, because that's where her biggest constellation is.
I think what's interesting is that Coulter started working with the Harvey Companies in, I think, 1904, and her first project was actually down in Albuquerque at the old Alvarado Hotel, which is, of course, no longer here. And then her last project was at La Fonda, and through that period, she did a series of projects at the Grand Canyon. And the reason that people know really as much as we do know about her is because there's so much at the Grand Canyon that's still left. So she did a series of buildings there basically between 1905 and 1933, which are still standing.
And what are they like?
You know, they're fabulous and they're different. There's the Hopi House, which was her first building in 1905, which is based on a kind of romanticized version of Pueblo architecture. It's a mix of Pueblo architecture and Hopi architecture, and it was a place where they actually brought in Hopi Indians to live and teach tourists about kind of the Hopi culture and the Pueblo culture, and so they sold pottery and they sold rugs and they sold Native American artifacts there. And so it was a way that the Harvey Companies and the railroad could actually kind of help explain to their visitors what they were entering into.
I think her most famous building that people would know is El Tovar. And El Tovar is still what I would call a very magical place at the Grand Canyon. And Barbara, what year did she build El Tovar?
You know, I'm actually not sure. And it would have been right around 1904. And again, I think she did some of the interior work at El Tovar, and she didn't actually do the structure there. So she did Bright Angel Lodge, and she did the Watchtower. And again, people who go to the Grand Canyon are still staying in those structures and still visiting those structures.
You asked, what are they like? I think that the word that I would use for her Grand Canyon collection of buildings is magical. They're still incredibly evocative. I mean, one of the things about her was her understanding of the site.
Yeah, so really blending with the landscape in a way that
beautifully
integrated.
She did a lot of research, and there's stories about her going out and flying over the Grand Canyon, which at the time in the early 1900s was kind of unheard of, and for a woman to get into a plane was, you know, probably
unusual,
a bit scandalous. She traveled to Indian dances, and she had a huge Indian jewelry collection and Indian pottery collection. So she was very much tied to the Native American storyline, and I think one of the first Native American artifacts she talks about, and Arnold Burke, who is one of the speakers at the event on the 1st and 2nd of April, talks about when she was a child, her mother gave her a Sioux ledger drawing that was done, you know, back in the 1850s.
Yeah, it was mid 19th century, and it was something that she cherished always. You know, I think one of the things about her is that she didn't consider herself a collector of these things. She lived with them. They were a part of her life, and I think she was really careful about not saying that they were things that she collected, but they were things that she used. She incorporated into her life. They spoke to her about the design aesthetic of the Southwest, and she. She was a real, she was really a magnificent interpreter of Southwestern archaeology, ethnography, history, and that we still go and see these places that she built in the Grand Canyon. And we still, when we go into La Fonda, the place where we're having our sponsors dinner on Friday night, I was just saying to Barbara, his always been my favorite room at La Fonda, and it's called the Santa Fe room. And I didn't know why I loved that room so much until Barbara said to me, that room is still about 90% Mary Coulter.
Right.
Very interesting. Well, there are some interesting stories about her. Maybe, I don't know if she was the first one to do faux finishing, but she took new, brand new things and made them look old and a little crusty and dirty to the point where people offered to clean them.
She absolutely did. And there's stories about her putting brand new cushions down on the floor and having workmen walk over the cushions in order to get that aged, authentic look. And I've been doing some additional research, and it's interesting how much correspondence there is between Meme and Coulter on La Fonda specifically, just in terms of the paint colors. She's sending paint chips, he's sending paint chips, she's sending a rock, I want this color, he sends something back, he doesn't like it, and so she doesn't like it. I mean, it's pages of information about how to get that distressed and old look. She did not want people to walk into a building and have it feel brand new.
And as probably anybody who's ever chosen a paint color and it ended up being wrong and painted their whole room knows, that level of attention to detail is really important. And she did it with every single detail, every stone,
correct,
every stick,
right,
every color.
Correct.
And I think even, I know that she must have observed places day and night to see how those colors would change between day and night, how those textures would read at different times of day.
Mm-hmm.
And she really was, in one of the letters that we found, it was written by one of the Harveys in the 1960s, and he's thinking back to his association with Mary Jane Harvey. Mary Jane Coulter, a new name. He's thinking about working with her, and he said she was sure of everything she did. And we're going to have Stephen Freed with us, and Stephen Freed has researched the Harvey companies, and he talks about the way in which the Harvey Coulter business sort of conglomerate is what created the hospitality that we've come to expect in the Southwest. When we walk into a place like La Fonda now, we feel at home, and we feel at home in it because we've come to know that that design that Harvey took to all their properties is what was created through that affiliation of Coulter and Harvey. So Stephen's going to talk a lot about how the Harveys came to hire Mary Jane Coulter and what she brought to the business as well, because it was that feedback between hotel and designer, between restaurant and designer, that is so crucial. Barbara and I were looking at photos last week of a photo of Union Station,
mm-hmm.
and you could tell that you just knew that Mary Jane Coulter walked through the room and placed all the napkins
correct
before they took the photo shot, because they were part of the interior design of the building. It was clear.
Right. And it's also interesting to think about, you know, being a woman back in that time frame and working for a railroad company and understanding that you're bringing clientele from big cities who may have never been out west. They've only heard stories. And so really, I think, you know, part of the magic of what Mary Elizabeth Jane Coulter brought was that notion of how to make the Southwest safe. And so making it feel comfortable, and it's clear, again, when you talk about, you know, it's an existing building, she worked with faux, she kind of aged things. All of that, I think, is about trying to make the guest feel comfortable.
So when you have this event, Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd, will people be able to, for example, walk through La Fonda and see, point to the actual influences of Coulter's work?
I think partially, yes. The unfortunate thing, as with a lot of Coulter's things that aren't at the Grand Canyon, a lot has been sold off or removed over the years. And so the items that we have been able to identify at La Fonda absolutely will point out. Because, again, it's part of the story and it's part of what makes it so great. And she clearly was a tactile person. And so sharing that experience is a huge part of what this weekend's about.
You are an architect and designer yourself. Have you been influenced by her work in your own?
Absolutely. I think it's the tie-in for me is I'm also not a native of the Southwest, so moving here as a transplant, learning the Native American story, the tie-in with the Hispanic culture, the Mexican story, all of those pieces tie into what I do, and I certainly look to her and think, boy, if she could do it 100 years ago, I'm pretty sure I can do it.
And I know that's one of the things that we'll talk about during this weekend is that on Friday night, we have just sort of a cocktail party and welcome, and then the sponsors' dinner in the Santa Fe room. And Barbara will talk about the Coulter aura, mm-hmm. the Coulter details, because that's the room where you really see it. And then on Saturday at 10:30 in the morning, April 2nd, Arnold will talk. We'll give the sort of longer biography of Mary Jane Coulter. And then in the afternoon, Barbara will do a talk at La Fonda. And Stephen will talk about the relationship between La Fonda, between Coulter and the Harveys.
And Stephen Fried, who wrote that wonderful book.
Right.
Appetite for America.
Mm-hmm.
Appetite for America.
Fabulous.
We had him on the air. That book reads like a novel.
I love that book. I could hardly put it down.
Yeah.
And Arnold's book about Mary Jane Coulter is absolutely beautiful. Arnold's book is called Mary Coulter, Architect of the Southwest. Arnold Burke, Berke. So then Saturday night during the dinner, we'll have a kind of studio. Actually, I think, Mary Charlotte, we're going to borrow your format here. And then we'll have all of us talking about what was that like for Mary Coulter to be an architect of such renown in the 1930s. And was she? You know,
right.
Was she in that period between 1902, actually, when she did the Alvarado, and 1957, when she did her last commission for La Fonda? She died in 58. What was it like to be a woman architect at that period of time?
Mm-hmm.
And why do we still now? What amazes me is, why do I walk into the Santa Fe room at La Fonda and say, I want to live here?
Right.
You know, what is it about that design? And Barbara and I were looking through historic photographs of La Fonda and just falling in love with things that she had done. Mm-hmm. Why does it still speak to us so many years later?
Very interesting question to explore.
Yeah, she had tremendous vision.
And why has she been forgotten? Maybe we can just chalk it up to sexism in art and architectural history.
I think there may be a part of that. It's funny, I was kind of wrestling with this question in my office earlier today. I think part of it is she didn't own a firm, so she worked for a giant company, and the company came first. And thank heavens that there's still things that are, you know, up and standing, because I don't know that we would know about her otherwise. And I'm guessing had she been a man who was working, I think there probably would be the same problem just because it was such a big company.
Or she would have had her own firm.
Or she would have had her own firm.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course, I don't think she's been forgotten, but that's because we live, breathe, and think about her. And when we did the exhibition design for the New Mexico History Museum, you know, we wanted the one sort of quintessential Southwest story to be outside of our auditorium, and we chose the Harvey Companies, the Harvey Indian Detour Companies, and Mary Jane Coulter as that quintessential Southwestern story that everyone would resonate to, and they do. And, mm-hmm. you know, we have some of Mary Jane Coulter's plans, we have lots of photos of her interiors. We're adding that great quote about her being unstoppable and absolutely sure of her vision.
Right.
That someone wrote about her. So I don't tend to think of her as being forgotten, but I think that's in the historical circles that
right.
she's not.
Right. You know. I guess I just compared to somebody like Meme, but as you say,
absolutely.
She was an employee of a big company
Correct.
That everybody has heard of, the
right.
Harvey Company.
Right.
You know, I think the other part of it is she, there are so many of her buildings that were lost. Of course, the Alvarado mm-hmm. Hotel was lost. And a lot of her buildings have continued to be converted. That's why the ones at Grand Canyon are so important, is because they're still there, primarily in that pristine setting, don't you think, in which she built them.
I do. I mean,
them.
They've really, and the Park Service has been able to maintain those.
And what's, I mean, in a way poignant, she lived to be 88 years old, mm-hmm. so she saw her work come and go within her lifetime.
Well, and there's a quote, because I think, and it might have been with the Alvarado Hotel, no, I can't remember, but it was a hotel that she saw demolished, and she said, I think I may have lived too long. So, you know, in her lifetime, she watched some of her work be destroyed.
We're talking to Fran Levine, director of the New Mexico History Museum, and Barbara Felix, architect and designer. And the History Museum and La Fonda, once again, are hosting this special event honoring Mary Elizabeth Jane Coulter, to use all her names, Friday and Saturday, the 1st and 2nd of April. So how do people get involved? How do they get tickets?
Tickets are available at ticketssantafe.org or at the Lansing box office. Or online, you know, online is one of the easiest ways to do it, through the ticketsantafe.org. The tickets are available for the whole weekend, so it's not like you could decide just to come Friday or Saturday. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing.
A full experience.
It's a full experience, and I think, you know, the three speakers, you know, talking about the Harvey House and the Harvey Companies, and then Arnold talking about Mary's work kind of a little bit more globally. I think it's going to be a great experience for people, and my guess is there's a lot more information coming.
And food. Remember that we've used the Harvey Company, we've used Stephen Fried's compilation of Harvey recipes to have Harvey-inspired and, in some case, actual Harvey recipes. So I think there's different dinners Friday and Saturday night. We think it's going to be yummy.
Fran and Barbara, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. And don't forget, the New Mexico History Museum is also on the web at nmhistorymuseum.org.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do you want to give your website?
Sure.
And Barbara, what's your website?
It's www.bjfelix.com.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Josh Kornbluth. His one-man show, Andy Warhol, Good for the Jews, is at the Lenzik this Thursday, March 24th, and Saturday, March 26th at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this show centers around an exhibition that you saw called Warhol's Jews, 10 Portraits Reconsidered. How did you come to be aware of this exhibition and then to start really interacting with these portraits?
It's really, it was, I mean, in retrospect, kind of magical, but the basic way was that I went to this new museum called the Contemporary Jewish Museum that had just opened in San Francisco at the time, a couple of years ago. And we live in Berkeley, across the bay. And when I was at the museum, I was approached by this guy named Dan Schifrin, who I had run into around the Bay Area. He hosts various events, and he's a writer. And he explained to me that they had hired him to run the public events at this museum, and they had an exhibit coming in. It was actually coming in very soon thereafter, so they were a little bit desperate, I think, but that it was going to be these 10 portraits that Andy Warhol had done of famous 20th century Jews. And they had commission money, and from grants. And was I interested in giving a talk about it? And I explained to him, well, I'd love the money for one thing, definitely. But you know, in honesty, I had to tell him that you know I knew nothing about Andy Warhol, very little about visual art, although I've always wanted to know a lot more. And I knew practically nothing about the Jews, even though I'm Jewish. So it was, and then he said, well, fine. You know, so I think he was desperate. And so it was this commission that made me come in and look at these portraits. And then when I saw them, I didn't like them.
Well, that's one of the fascinating things about it. You didn't like them. Why didn't you like them?
Well, I felt like they didn't like me, and I didn't like them. That was my first reaction. It was my first take on these portraits, you know, was that Andy Warhol, about whom at that point I knew nothing, except, you know, he'd done Campbell Soup Cans and 15 Minutes of Fame and the Velvet, he had helped produce the Velvet Underground, one of my favorite bands. But aside from that, I knew nothing. And my sense was that, well, I looked at it and I just thought, well, he doesn't. Obviously, the artist, Warhol, did not care at all about these people. And my idea of a portrait is, you know, it reveals something of the soul. It moves me. And that's my idea of art in general, that it moved me in some way or it transformed me. And I felt that it was like looking at these flat things that had just been sort of automatically, like, put into, you know, a Warhol machine and added, you know, those colors and so I was initially quite put off by them. And in fact, that was, in a way, in retrospect, it was sort of the first indication that there was something going on in the show, because one of the things that happened to me, even in my initial repulsion as I first responded to the pictures, was it made me feel very Jewish. I felt very, which is unusual, I felt very sort of protective of, you know, these people about whom also I knew very little for the most part, who were pictured in the portrait. So it was it set in motion this very complicated and very, at first, very negative response in me. But I had to keep looking at them, and I had to keep trying to find a way to connect, because I was being paid to talk about them and to talk about how I connected with them.
Why did you, being a Jew, not feel Jewish or feel connected to Jewish themes?
Well, I felt, I mean, it's really sort of as a typical Jewish answer. Well, I guess a super typical Jewish answer would be to answer with a question, but instead I'll answer with sort of a two-part answer. The first part is that I have always felt Jewish in a way. I mean, I in the show, I quote from Jonathan Miller, the great British humorist, who says to himself, he says, I'm not a Jew precisely, I'm Jew-ish. And I guess I've always felt Jew-ish. I've always been culturally Jewish. My parents, you know, my parents spoke Yiddish and, you know, were very clearly Jewish. But in another way, I wasn't Jewish at all. And by that, I mean that I wasn't raised at all in any religious sense Jewish whatsoever. In fact, my parents were communists and they had rejected religion as the opiate of the masses. of course, they didn't realize that they actually had a new religion called communism. But so they were atheists, and so I never went to temple. I had no identification with the State of Israel, with Zionism, or anything like that. So a lot of the things that I think about as being typically what a Jew does, what a Jew is, I was never bar mitzvahed, you know, that I did not happen to me, you know, and had not happened to me. And now at the age of 50, which is where I was turning around at the time when I saw these portraits, I found as I began to, almost despite myself, connect with these portraits and with Warhol, that I was also connecting with Judaism and with Jewishness in a way that just totally surprised me and continues to this moment to be a very a transformative experience for me.
Well, I found it just amazing and just fascinating that you started looking at the Warhol work, which, you know, to my eyes as well, I have to say, I think of consumerism and glitz and superficiality. You started with the lens, or you found the lens of Martin Buber and his ideas of I and thou as a way of beholding these portraits, and that was transformative.
The Buber really is at the center of this. Buber is one of the 10 subjects in these portraits, and famous, or some of them not so famous anymore, like Buber. I would say probably Buber is the least known of all of them right now to most people. And I knew nothing. When Warhol in his diary, when he was working on these portraits, he wrote, "Who is Martin Buber?" And so I was with Warhol there. I didn't know anything about Buber, except that I remembered that my father, and I still have it, in fact, my father, who, as I said, was a Jewish communist, his best friend was a Presbyterian minister who was also a communist. And as it happens, this dear friend of my father's, who became a dear friend of mine, almost like a second father to me, Chuck Yerkes was his name, had labored for years and years on his doctoral dissertation in divinity on Martin Buber and Buber's philosophy of I and Thou. And in the manner peculiar to my father's friends, Chuck, even though I was a child, treated me as if I were an adult, in that he would read me all of these versions, all the rewrites of his doctoral dissertation on Martin Buber. He's reading it to an 8-year-old. I mean, incredibly abstruse stuff, except some of it stuck. And what particularly stuck with me and really was unlocked for me in this experience of reacting to these portraits and, you know, in a profound way, was an encounter with Martin Buber myself and with his philosophy of I and Thou, which I find to be incredibly powerful.
And just so that people understand, the I-Thou relationship is different from the I-It relationship, in which people or whatever that you're beholding is objectified, as opposed to maybe a kind of reverence or honesty or vulnerability that takes place in the I-Thou interaction.
I mean, yes, exactly. I mean, to my end, I'm still learning it. But what you say, you actually said it very beautifully. And I mean, people see each other, Buber felt, as it. They see as the other. And that he felt that the only way to him, the only way to what he considered God, the only way to what he called the absolute, was through human beings encountering one another, not as an it, not as an object, but as a fellow subject, encountering them in that way that you said, in a way that is, you know, vulnerable, intimate, honest. And he didn't expect that it would, you know, he said it didn't happen very often, and when it happened, it would last sometimes just very briefly. So these were moments, these I-Thou moments, were to be treasured. And it's just, I found it, and I'm starting, really beginning my Buber studies, I feel like. But in this piece, what happens is that I, in Andy Warhol, Good for the Jews, is that I find myself entering into an I-Thou relationship with Andy Warhol himself, with the members, you know, with some of the portrait subjects, and also very, very surprisingly to me, as the show developed, with a side of my family that had totally cut off my side of the family with my father's parents, who had disowned him and then pretty much disowned me and everyone connected to me. And I found myself really unexpectedly through the process of developing the show, which was all a reaction to those 10 portraits, that I found myself really entering into a kind of a healing, an intergenerational healing that I never expected to happen in my lifetime.
We're talking to Josh Kornbluth about his one-man show that's coming up at the Lensic, Andy Warhol, Good for the Jews. And I haven't seen it yet in person. I saw the DVD of one of the performances that you've done. And it goes far into so many themes beyond art. It deals with, as you say, family, God, Jewishness. And it really made me think about what a trip to the museum can inspire and how so much of the value of a work of visual art is what it evokes in others and what they then do with it. And what you've done with it is it's a whole new work of art.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And that'll be very gratifying to Dan Shiffrin, who I mentioned, who was the friend who hired me for this gig, who gave me the commission, because his idea, and he's still at the Contemporary Jewish Museum, by the way, and it's still, you know, his idea was, in even inviting me, was to try to bring a fresh angle onto the museum experience that, you know, for the original talks that I gave, which were to the, you know, people at the museum, that, you know, normally you have a docent maybe shows you around or a curator, but the idea of having essentially one of your fellow museum goers who is no more knowledgeable than you are and probably less, in this case me, to go and then to have a deep experience and then to share it was just, you know, as you indicated, I mean, his hope was that it wouldn't just be about that particular exhibit and my particular response to it, but it would help to, you know, it would help people to think about what they get out of art, what they get out of museum going, and help, you know, sort of enhance that experience. So, and that's extremely gratifying to me that you feel that.
Yeah, very much so, because I wonder sometimes when I go see things myself, the experience as you're having it in a museum or in any form of cultural interaction can be pleasant and even profound at moments, but what do you take home from it? What do you do with it? How does it change you? And I think it's just a beautiful example of how there is a kind of a chain reaction, because then the next person will go to your performance and they'll have a response to that that comes out in their own work or their own life.
That's just wonderful. That would be my greatest hope, you know, is to be a part in, to be a little link in that chain of interaction, of response, and of, you know, self-discovery for each of us. And self-discovery and also our discovery of how we're connected with the rest of the universe. You know, it's a big goal, but to, you know, we're all on that quest. And I had the same questions that when I said earlier in our conversation that I was, you know, I didn't know very much about visual art. I mean, it was really true. And one of the things was that I sort of felt like I listen to music a lot, I go to movies a lot, I read a lot, but that I never sort of, as you were sort of talking about, I never sort of got what I'm supposed to do at a museum, especially at an art museum. I just didn't know even how to gauge it or what was happening. And, you know, even as you were describing it, I was actually also thinking that I had and have had a similar question about nature, about the beauty of nature, when, you know, my wife and son both love nature, and I'm, you know, as I'm from New York City, and to quote Woody Allen, I'm at two with nature, you know, and and we have gone to these beautiful places. I've gone to these people who are the dearest people to me in the world, and I've known that it is a beautiful experience that's happening, and I look out and I see the sunset and I see the stars, and yet it's through my impulses to, would someone please put this in a story so that I can then sit in an air-conditioned delicatessen and eat and read about this and then have the actual emotional experience that I should be having right now. And so
I've spoken like a true New Yorker.
Yes, I know. And so it won't, by the way, parenthetically, it won't surprise you, I don't know how to drive either. But that's, and so in a way, this is also part of my experience of trying to connect with and feel, because I feel it, but to try to explicate, dramatize, and feel, I guess, to really feel myself what I am getting from visual art and what it can release in me and, you know, and perhaps in others. And so it's really, that's been, I mean, that was one of the scariest things to me about the commission, was that I would be talking about works of visual art, and I didn't know, you know, I'm getting this wrong, but something about like music criticism, like writing about music is like dancing about sculpture or something like that.
Right,
does it not connect, you know? And although now they think about dancing like sculpture, it would probably be really beautiful if it wasn't by me. But you know what, that was the thing, like how would what I do, which is tell stories essentially from my life based on my experience and reporting on that, how could I bring that to bear on works of visual art? And so one of the things that's gratifying to me about doing the show is that I have connected.
Josh Kornbluth's one-man show is called Andy Warhol, Good for the Jews, and it's at the Lensic on Thursday, March 24th, and Saturday, March 26th at 7 o'clock. Absolutely wonderful show. I hope that everybody goes to see it. Josh Kornbluth, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Armand Saia. He's the director of Desert Grows, which is at desertgrows.org. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you.
So,
my pleasure.
You're all about local food production, and getting that local food to the people who need it most.
That's true. And I believe that organic and local, locally produced vegetables and all produce should go to all people. I don't think it should be exclusive because of price. I think that it should get to all people, and that's what we try to do. So we've been started a program to try to support our local growers in Rivera area and the 13 satellite communities, and buy from those farms so that we can bolster their abilities to produce and get that food out. And I've been getting that food out through the food bank system. So instead of getting the commodities that are usually equated with food banks, we're now bringing lots of produce. So the money that's come into Desert Grows has immediately gone out and been translated into fresh produce and gone out through this food bank system, especially to Christ Church in Caruco to start. It will be in Bernal, will be in Las Vegas, at the Methodist Church in Las Vegas on 8th and University, and maybe Bienvenidos too here in town. So if we can get enough, if we can get enough money to come in, then we can buy this produce and get it out through the system. And you know, nutritional insecurity is something that's very, very under-talked about and misunderstood. And I think that, you know, when you look at San Miguel County and you see how many people are hungry or the foods that are consumed and the lack of nutrition there, it's staggering.
And people also tend not to make the connection between lack of nutrition and obesity. People are seeking nutrition. They keep stuffing themselves with empty calories and they get fat
and
because they're still not getting
obesity,
the nutrition.
Yeah. Which is unbelievable. It's just, it's a shame. And so in doing that, and by doing that, we are building community, which is huge. So by bringing people in, we've started something called the Cooperative Workforce Network. This brings volunteers to the farms. Then we are scheduling all of this so that a farmer needs to plant, and he needs 10 hands to do that so that he can plant without gasoline or any equipment and do it all by hand. Then we'll deliver those 10 people, those volunteers, to a farm at a special time and place and get that job done. And then they pay that back by putting hours back into the workforce network. So if there are any volunteers out there that really want to work with Desert Grows, please go to desertgrows.org and look at the website, read up on us, study us, ask us whatever questions you want, and get involved.
So I think there's a lot of people and a lot of young people who are interested in returning to the land, whether it be full-time or part-time, but learning organic farming and learning the whole cycle of food production.
Yes, and this particular area has the best land. It's absolutely magnificent. It is the Pecos Valley. It has been farmed for, I dare to say, 10,000 years. I'm sure all the anthropologists and archaeologists will, you know, jump on me for that one. But the truth is that every year it gets pushed back further. And people who build houses out of stone aren't running around, you know, chasing animals. They're growing food. And that's what
right.
they were doing there, and it's a beautiful valley, and there are so many opportunities for young growers, and we want to bring them all out there, and that's why we're trying to create this. There are four brand new small farmers markets between Santa Fe and Las Vegas, and this is where we focus all of our energy. We sell all of our stuff there. We've stuck through it from the beginning, through thick and thin, because we believe in building this food network. And
so you can find out at desertgrows.org where those farmers markets are. So if our listeners live,
yes.
say, closer to Pecos than Santa Fe, yep. they can go to those.
Well, I can do it quick. It's El Dorado, Pecos, El Valle, and then the Tri-County Market in Las Vegas. It's that one has been revamped. And it's been there for 80 years, but now we have 36 growers, and I can't even tell you the varieties. I tested 60 varieties of vegetables last year. I'm going to grow artichokes this year. I'm going
really?
To grow, yes, I'm trying a whole bunch of things.
Now, you grow, what, 12 months a year?
Four seasons, and that's a big emphasis, and that's what we're trying to encourage and help people with. So, you know, there are subsidies for all kinds of farm subsidies, but it does not trickle down to these small farms. That's what Desert Grows is about, too. We're trying to help strengthen these farms, and we want them to reach sustainability and grow. And if they can grow, I'm not talking about big production. I'm talking big enough to feed maybe 1,000 people in four seasons. If we could do that, just every little teeny farm, we could begin to build a new food network that would be very secure. And
which is very important, because the degradation of soil, the degradation of rivers, of the air, basically of our entire environment, is so dangerous. And, I mean, a lot of individuals are paying attention to it, but on a political level, it's just going on business as usual.
That's true. And organic techniques incorporate using organic materials, all different kinds of poops. We are the poop kings. We love it. You know, we got chicken poop for one thing. We have cow manure for another. We have horse for another. We can use all of these manures and do very, very, very well with soil. And here, a typical acre of New Mexican caliche here takes 20 tons of organic material to bring it to loam status. And that's our intention. That's our goal. Build this soil up. Keep it there. I like fixed beds and low-till or no-till. Okay? I'd like to eliminate all petrol fuels from farming, do it all by hand, and be able to feed everybody. And I think we can do it.
Have you calculated how many horses and cows and chickens you need to make 20 tons of poo?
You need a lot, but you know they have multi-purposes, and they're great friends too. So, you know, we love our animals.
And that's the idea of the closed loop farm, where you have the animal poo fertilizing the fields, which in turn lettuce that feeds the animal, plants that feed the animals, and so on.
Yeah, and water conservation, all of it, and being able to do that. I'd love to have a fish farm. I'd love to have a tilapia farm, water in, water out into the Pecos, and be able to take that poop out, make the food that we need out of it, and to feed that soil, and to keep our biospheres living so that we can feed those roots. You know, that's another thing about local food. If you're doing it by hand and you're doing it like that, you're getting real food. So there's a slight premium you're paying, but you're paying for something that's incredible, and you're paying for food security.
And you're probably saving that money in vitamin pills.
There you go.
I went to the Alamosa, Colorado alligator farm, the gator farm, and they have closed loop fish tanks. So they've got these round fish tanks with tropical fish swimming in them. There's all kinds of fish swimming in them that they feed to the alligators. The water gets pumped up to these tropical plants that then filter the dirty fish water, and it filters down clean back into the fish tanks. It's completely self-contained.
Yeah. So I'd like to play with those techniques and that science. And, you know, it's all about science. It's all about doing... This is the other thing. This happened not that long ago. You can go back 60, 70 years ago, and my valley used to feed itself.
Right.
And they used to barter for what they didn't have.
Right.
So someone had chickens, someone had cows, someone grew vegetables, and it all worked out, and everyone had complete diets. This can happen again. So if there are no trucks, if we could no longer truck fight, you can see in any minute something could happen. Anywhere.
Another thing that's interesting about it is that you're using science. You're also using low-tech means. So you're doing things by hand. You're having very inexpensive plastic-covered greenhouses, things like that.
And that's how you do it. I use no heat, and we use techniques to keep things warm. And we use row covers to cover up. I made it through 20 below zero. I didn't miss a beat. I didn't lose every other greenhouse was killed off.
And how did you do it?
Except mine. I watered the night before to pull the heat up. Then I put row cover laying over all of the plants so that the heat came up and got trapped under the row cover and made a little shield. So the condensation on the row cover made an ice cave that kept everything alive, kept all wind and all wind chill. And so they didn't freeze dry. They didn't, and everyone else is freeze-dried because it was just so unusually cold.
And next
amazing.
Year they'll know how to do it because you figured it out.
Right. Well, and it could have been dumb luck. You know, one never knows. But I'm thrilled with my greenhouses. I have three of them, big ones, and I have bees. And now I have arugula going to flowers. I have tatsoi going to flower. I have the only flowers in the valley, and my bees are feasting. So today we bought weed seed. We bought dandelions and planted them everywhere because they'll be up in 2 weeks. Now I have dandelions everywhere in 2 weeks so that I can feed these bees. So that's my newest strategy. And then I'm putting in 7 acres of buckwheat to feed them.
You are a nonprofit and you are looking for volunteers, and you have this, as you say, this network of people who help each other. And also, if people want to make donations, the money goes straight to farmers whose food then goes to food pantries, so people who are in the economic crisis not only get to eat, but get to eat really good food.
Yes, and they're thrilled. And it took me weeks to get people to begin to look at these foods, say, oh, we don't eat that. But we're also doing cooking demonstrations. We're teaching people how to cook things. We're bringing in nutritionists to teach people about why you eat certain things and what it does. We could wipe out type 2 diabetes in San Miguel County, which is the second highest in the state, and obesity, we can get chi flowing again just by eating these vegetables.
Right.
And that is what we need to do, and people are getting it. I thought it was going to be a tough sell, but it is not. And it's surprisingly successful and right out of the gate. So we're talking about 3 months doing this, and yes, we need money. We need money, and we need money now because we need to keep this going constantly. So money comes in. If people could figure out a way just to give a little every once in a while, we're going to be there. We're going to keep doing this. We're transparent. You can see what we're doing. And I would like to invite everyone to come out
to
visit us. Come out to Ribera. Come out to Infinity Farm. That's my farm. And take a tour. See what we're doing. Feel it for yourself. And then you'll understand what Desert Grows is about.
It's desertgrows.org. Armand Saia is the creator of this wonderful institution. And let's get you back for an update sometime over the summer when the food is growing, growing big and sweet and delicious. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.